time, those of you who are present heard me give the last speech for the last meeting of the Institute, but there was one more. And I think I said at that time that we'd have one special lecture to follow, and this is it. We're deeply indebted to the Sun Publishing Company for bringing to us tonight Mary Hemingway. And this is the last lecture of this session. I'm going to ask Mr. Stuart Keat, publisher of the Sun, if he'd be good enough to introduce our guest.
Thank you, Judge Rattan. Ladies and gentlemen, it's a great pleasure on behalf of the Sun to welcome you all here this evening. Our guest of honor, Mary Welsh Hemingway, has flown across the continent from her home in New York to be with us, and we are delighted to welcome her here on her first visit to Vancouver. When we chatted about arrangements on the telephone a few days ago, Mrs. Hemingway asked me about the climate in Vancouver, and I gave her my solemn oath and covenant that it never rained in this city, then adding, bring a Burberry. That's what we call in the newspaper business a backup story. However, it's all academic. Last night at 8 o'clock, when the situation developed, Mary Hemingway in Vancouver, luggage in Seattle. It's also a pleasure to collaborate in the staging of the Sun's annual journalism lecture with the Vancouver Institute, an association we have enjoyed for many years. I think you will all agree that the season of lectures concluding tonight has been both informative and lively. Now, our guest of honor was born in the lumbering country of Walker, Minnesota, and very early in life decided that she wanted to be a journalist. In her recent best-selling book, How It Was, Mrs. Hemingway wrote, "With his poem Chicago, Carl Sandburg changed the ambience of my youth. And since my childhood, when the editor of Bemidji Pioneer came to our house for dinner, I had known that I would like to work on a newspaper." She enrolled in journalism at Northwestern, but in less than 2 years chose to forfeit the security of a liberal arts degree in order to work as editor of a magazine called, would you believe, The American Florist. Apparently, Mary, the pay wasn't quite equal to the perfume. At any rate, she went to work for some neighborhood weeklies, which were even worse, but at least they resembled a newspaper. Nevertheless, this harsh depression apprenticeship led Mary to the famous Chicago Daily News, where she caught on as an assistant on what they used to call the society pages. This was the paper of Ben Hecht and Charles MacArthur of front page fame. It was also the paper of John Gunther, Vincent Sheehan, Bob Casey, and a giant step forward for a young lady who wanted, as she said, to be a real reporter. In 1936, she had an opportunity to go overseas, and in London, she met a young bureau chief who suggested that she should beard that eccentric Canadian, Lord Beaverbrook, about a job on the London Express. The Beaver was not amused when she called and said only that he would give her tea and 15 minutes. Mary told the great man that she wanted to come to London to, quote, cover the war, unquote, at which he frowned and said, "In one of the great prophecies of all time, there will be no war, mark you." In due course, after she had rejected a Beaverbrook offer as a personal reader on a trip down the Nile, she was hired by the Daily Express. And after the fall of France, she decided that she wanted to work for an American publication. She resigned from the Express, and on July 10, 1940, which incidentally was the opening day of the Battle of Britain, she started to work in the London Bureau of Time, Life, and Fortune. As is well known, her talent and her zeal and her courage quickly established her as one of the outstanding correspondents of World War II. She was indeed a name in her own right, an established reputation, when in 1944 she had her first glimpse of Ernest Hemingway. She was having lunch with Irwin Shaw, of rich man, poor man fame, when Hemingway ambled over to their table and said, introduce me to your friend, Shaw. Two meetings later, according to the legend, Hemingway said, I don't know you, Mary, but I want to marry you. Now, I think that's about all the bio I should reveal. The rest you can find in fascinating detail in this book, which incidentally sells in Vancouver for $15 a copy.
What?
We pay a premium for our American culture in this country. But after all, we get Mary Hartman for nothing, which is precisely what it's worth. Well, when we were discussing a topic for this evening, Mrs. Hemingway said, now look, I'm not an orator. What I'd like to do is chat with the audience on a variety of subjects, such as writers I have known, London during the Blitz, fishing on the Pilar in the Gulf Stream, the delights of an old-fashioned safari in Africa, and the calm amid hubbub at the Finca Vigia in Cuba. So I said to her, well, why not on this last night of the Institute lecture season, keep it informal and call it simply An Evening with Mary Hemingway. So that all what we're going to do, Mrs. Hemingway will speak for about an hour or so, after which we will have some questions on topics of your choice. And I invite you now to join me in a warm Canadian welcome to a very nice lady, Mary Walsh Hemingway.
Can you hear me? Everywhere? No? We turn something here.
Would you like to use a throat microphone?
Well, I can, if you think it's better.
I think it will. Here.
Then we turn one off.
I think they'll
you
be
able to hear me on both.
No, I think they can hear you on both, and it's fine to use both. So I'll try that and see how it gets on.
How about this? Is this better? All right. After that really too flattering introduction, I have to say that I thought it would amuse you to hear about some of the other writers I can't say the word knew, but some of the other writers I encountered before we get on to the writer who obviously interested me more than any of the others, interested me and occupied me, one might say. You may remember Mr. Carl Sandburg, who on the days when I was a reporter on the Chicago Daily News, Mr. Sandburg used to come in once a week. He had a farm somewhere in Illinois or Indiana. He used to come into the office once a week to bring to the editor a few little paragraphs of verse or some aphorisms, something like that, and got into the habit of stopping in to see us girls who were in the women's department, sitting on our desks, making chit-chat, learning the latest office gossip, all that kind of thing. And then he also began the habit of inviting some of us. He stayed in a rather second-class hotel somewhere near the office in Chicago and would invite some of us to stop in on our way home from work to sit around, and he would have his guitar and jokes and gossip, and we would sit until I always got too hungry. I finally had to go home. But he would make a sort of little personal private entertainments, a thing which amused him and indeed amused us also. And we were enormously impressed by being invited to have a drop of whiskey with Mr. Sandburg. From the moment he knew that I was born and raised in northern Minnesota, he called me Minnesota and nothing else. I think he probably forgot my real name. Anyhow, at one of these sessions in his hotel, three or four of us sitting around on one of the beds with our legs dangling over the side, I had for a long time noticed that Mr. Sandberg had a lock of hair which kept falling over his face and which he kept brushing back consistently. I had the temerity that evening to say to Mr. Sandberg, you know, the drugstores have some sort of goop that will you can put on your hair which will prevent that lock from bothering you, falling over your forehead, so that you don't have to brush it back all the time. And Mr. Sandberg looked rather shamefaced, perhaps, and said, you know, Mary, I think it makes me look rather like the country boy I wish to be. Anyhow, we sang, he would sing his songs, and I went, he used to do these evenings of guitar and chat and light-hearted conversation of one sort or another around Chicago, and after I had attended and gone to several of them, I decided that really his repertoire should perhaps be a little bit enlarged. He sang country songs, very pleasant country songs, but I thought that it was a bit limited. And so on another occasion in the rather second-rate hotel room, I said with enormous temerity, I said, and bad judgment, I said, I think you ought to increase enlarge your repertoire. And I suggested to him that he add a song which my father had taught me when I was a youngster, and we used to trundle along the gravel roads of northern Minnesota, narrow gravel roads in my father's Model T Ford. It was a song which went like this. Tooralooralooral, Tooralooralee, Tooralooralooral, it's an Irish melody. Mr. Sandberg said, for heaven's sake, Minnesota, you don't expect me, a Swede, to sing an Irish song. Of course, I was full of apologies. I hadn't realized that he had really no connection whatsoever with the Irish people. We skip a number of years. I've gone to London. I've been a correspondent for the London Daily Express, and I was then on Time magazine, and in 1942, the Time Inc. of New York decided that I should be brought back to the New York office to be somehow or other inspired by the mystique of the head office, that sort of thing. I'd been a correspondent for a couple of years in London, but had never worked in the New York office. And during that short time there in New York, was invited to the Luce's house. They had a very elegant place in Connecticut, which was simply called, I thought with a certain, perhaps, arrogance, the house. Anyhow, so in my really terribly cheap, bought off the rack, simple black dress, because in London during the Blitz, nobody wore evening clothes, and I had none left. I don't know what, anyway, they'd been lost or something. Bomb, perhaps. Anyhow, I went to the Luce's very elegant weekend, and we were sitting on the veranda of the house, which was really, really had a handsome view of dim green dales and vales and misty greens in the late afternoon sunlight. I suppose it was July. When the butler came to announce that dinner was served, and Mrs. Luce, who was, as you might know, commander of all she surveyed, said, we will not wait for our other guests. she had been anticipating three other guests, including Mr. Sandberg. And she got up and led the way to the dining room, which the walls of which were, I think I can truthfully aver, pink padded satin, like a baby's bassinet. The whole walls of the dining room. Anyway, as we were approaching, following our hostess, in burst Mr. Sandberg with his weekend hosts, and completely ignoring our hostess, he yelled at me, "Minnesota, where have you been? Why haven't I heard from you? Da, 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 da. Give me a hug. Tell me where you've been. Da, 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 da." Of course, I anticipated that the next Monday morning, there would be a note in my box at Time Life saying, "Your services are no longer required." However, the Luces were very generous about that. Mrs. Luce forgave me for Mr. Sandberg's bad manners, and they kept me on. In 1954, Ernest and I were in Cuba when we learned by telephone that he had won the Nobel Prize for Literature. And in answer to questions from the all sorts of the American press, United States press, over the telephone, he mentioned that he thought more deserving of the prize than he were Isaac Dinesen, who had written that marvelous book called A Danish Lady, who had written Out of Africa, very, very good book, and Mr. Carl Sandburg. I suppose his most famous thing were not his poems so much as his biography of Lincoln. Anyway, so soon the telephone rang, and it was Mr. Sandberg on the phone from wherever he lived, one of the Carolinas, I think, saying, I was listening in, of course, Ernest was had the receiver, but he was saying, "Gee, Ernie, that was awful nice of you to mention me in your reply to the announcement of the Nobel Prize." And this was 20 years later than I had first heard Mr. Sandberg sing his non-Irish songs, and his voice was still as melodious as it ever had been. So we switched to, and I'm talking about other writers before I get to my favorite writer. In London, this would have been about 1942. I was working in the Bureau of Time there in Dean Street, Soho, and noticed in the newspaper that a revival was being done of Mr. G.B. Shaw's play Pygmalion, just down the street from the office. And so thought, since rehearsals were going on, that I would pop into a rehearsal and see how people were doing. And saw striding, but really striding, not sloughing or slouching, a very slim, very erect, white-haired figure walking down Dean Street. Mr. Shaw, inevitably. So I caught up with him, and I said, "Mr. Shaw, I presume you're going to watch a rehearsal of your play. Do you mind if I accompany you," or something like that. He was quite tall. He looked, and very clean. Such a clean old man. Anyway, he looked down over his shoulder to me and said, "Who are you?" And I lied. I said, "I'm the theater reviewer for Time Incorporated." Pardon? Actually, all of us reporters were everything. It was not really a lie, because of whatever happened in London, we were reporting on. And, you know, just trying to make idiotic conversation, I said, "You're looking so very well, Mr. Shaw. I do wish that all the playwrights looked as handsome as they write." Mr. Shaw again looked down upon me and said something which at that time stuck in my head very firmly indeed. The sentence, "The surfaces of objects seldom proclaim their contents." Well, I wrote it down as soon as I could get my hand on a piece of paper, my hand and pencil. There came a day, for some reason or other, I was in the office, the London Bureau of Time, on a Sunday afternoon when came through a cable saying that Mr. Luce would like further elucidation of a speech which Mr. H.G. Wells had made to the London Bureau of PEN, as you may know, that's the international organization of the acronym for poets, essayists, and novelists, which is worldwide. And in the London branch, Mr. Wells had said something about which Mr. Luce wished to know more. And so I called up Mr. Wells. I don't know how I got his phone number, but anyway, I found it. And Mr. Wells, this was mid-afternoon on a Sunday, he said, well, rather grumpily, yes, I can give you 10 minutes if you get up here right away, or something like that. So I got up there as soon as possible. Mr. Wells showed me around his house. He showed me his obviously very elegant carpets, which had been rolled up into cigar shapes, which he explained was because it would be for easier removal in case the house caught fire from the Blitz. And at some length explained that his maids were not there at that moment because they were very busy being air raid wardens. It was a thing which the servants loved to do. It kept them out of the house and gave them a good excuse for not doing their work at home. Anyway, rather than 10 minutes, about an hour and a half later, Mr. Wells finally gave me all he remembered having said at the London PEN meeting. And when he got to the door, open the door, he was certainly not taller than me, stuck his foot out like that, and stuck his face out like that, and said, I extract an exit permit. So I gave him a great big wet kiss on the cheek and rushed back to the office in order to pound out our deadlines were Sunday night, I think, on those days from London, pound out whatever he had told me about his speech to PEN. In 1940 in London, you may or may not remember that the Blitz, the German Blitz, France fell in late June of 1940, and the Germans moved their bombers and also a lot of their fighter squadrons to the north coast of France. And in 1940, on the night of September 7th, began their nightly bombings of London, sending over, as a rule, something like 200 bombers a night, planning to break or badly bend British morale for fighting the war. And many times they came, if the weather were good, they would come twice. Each bomber would make two journeys the same night. At that same time, the BBC invited me to be a commentator for what they called, you would understand this better than most Americans, the EMPAH. They wished me to make a 13 and a half minute broadcast, I think it was three times a week, to whatever it could be, little scenes of London, little incidents about people or whatever. to be broadcast to the empire. And the particular requirement for this was that one appear at the BBC at 2:30 a.m. I was sandwiched between, my little thing was sandwiched between that of J.B. Priestley, who had marvelous morale-building, courageous things to say always, not only to the people in England, on which he was a steady speaker in the home programs, but also to the empire. And on the other side of me was Mr. Leslie Howard, a dear, charming man. We used to go down. By that time, the BBC had moved its, what do you call it, the tea room thing, down into the absolute roots of the building, way down 4 or 5 flights of stairs. And we used to meet there, having taken a taxi, the only taxi stand in London that winter of 1940 with a bad blitz, the worst of the blitz, was that which lined itself up outside the BBC. They had their own little telephone booth right outside the building. And these dear old bundled up drivers would come down. I lived then in Lansdowne House in Berkeley Square, and take us aboard and trundle us up to the BBC and then later bring us home. But I remember saying to Mr. Priestley, having absolutely no acquaintance whatsoever with microphones, what's the one thing I ought to learn about dealing with these machines? And Mr. Priestley said, sound sincere, my child. It doesn't really matter. And he had this marvelous, strong Midlands accent. It doesn't really matter whether or not you are being totally truthful, but sound sincere. Very good advice indeed. I've tried ever since to sound sincere, even when I'm telling the most outrageous lies, which I try not to do very much. I was saying about the blitz, the night blitz beginning on September 7th of 1940, for 57 nights without any relief of whatever the word is, with 10 to 20,000 Londoners made homeless every night, people somehow or other making what they called making do. They moved in with relatives, they patched together if there were enough house left to patch together. They patched it together somehow or other. I remember going down to the East End one day as a reporter on Time. I helped Time establish what in those days for 6 months or more was a department of Time Inc. Of the magazine called People's War, and I was largely responsible for filling up that space. It included talking to various construction people, saying what kind of thing resisted bombs best, what sort of construction, what was the best protection, and all that kind of thing. And I remember going to the East End one time where a church warden and his wife and one child had gone to the church to spend this night of bad bombing. They bombed the East End primarily because of the docks, and they thought they could ruin the shipping, and also that somehow or other the rather poorer people of London who lived in the East End would ask for some sort of a relief from this kind of thing. I remember talking to the church warden, and his wife had slept in the church, but their house had been ruined. And I remember his wife saying, I'll miss the wireless. The wireless, of course, was just a bunch of strings and bits of metal and really nothing much. of any sort. With good judgment, it seemed to me, the government brought because there were so many houses bombed, and London in those days was frequently a town of 2 to 3 story smallish houses, and sometimes a bomb would demolish 5 or 6 at a time, sometimes only 2 or 3. But the government brought up to London a great contingent of Welsh miners who were the most expert in the United Kingdom because people were forever being buried under the walls or the fallen walls or more seriously wounding whoever might be still alive down in the depths there. And I remember one incident of a block of workers' flats, which happened to be quite near Ed and Janet Murrow. Ed and Janet Murrow, Ed was, CBS for years. He used to do that program called, I think, This is London, broadcast from the BBC, basically to the West. Anyway, I remember one morning in the air, really smelling nasty of cordite in this gray, smoky London morning, seeing a child who was being looked after. The tea ladies, the people who ran the little vans that served tea, were forever on duty, and they were there already at this particular site which had been bombed during the night. And a little boy coming away from the tea ladies and running toward me and saying, "My mum's down there. My mum's down there." I tried to comfort him, saying something such as, "Darling, your mum's going to be all right." And he pulled away. He had never heard, I presume, he had never heard the word darling. And so instead I said, chicks or some very British London word, not toots, but chicky or something like that. Anyway, and I held him in my arms and for a while, and then underneath he was padded in sweaters, not cold, but he was terrified, of course. And I felt that finally the muscles underneath those sweaters began to relax a little bit. Of course, the Goring's whole idea was that he was going to break the spirit of the British with these bombings, and primarily by bombing London. And he thought that somehow or other it would there would be some objection to this terrible torment that the 7 million people of London were being put into every night. The whole city went underground, almost, not necessarily all of us, but I used to walk the platforms of the underground, which was the subway, and see great, huge families. They went down every night with their blankets and their tea and their whatever. And I used to come back thinking, that they would certainly spend a most uncomfortable night, but they would be willing and eager to get to work the next day. We were not aware that Air Chief Marshal Stuffy Dowding's forces were so terribly decimated by the end of that fall. We didn't know that he had absolutely no reserves in the south of England at all. By the end, by September 15th, he had only 49 fighter squadrons in the whole of Britain. And those in the south had their airfields had been so damaged that they could no longer use them. And of course, we didn't know that and wouldn't dream to have attempted to cable it anyway. We didn't wish I'm speaking now of the American correspondents over there entirely. We didn't wish to give any aid or comfort to the enemy in any way whatsoever. But it was a terribly stirring, dramatic time for anyone who was there, especially people like me whose job was to observe what was happening in that city. I remember particularly that there were some raids were worse than others, but I remember the fire raid of December 29th. One of the Germans' principal ideas of you know, the great fun was to bomb, spread fire bombs all over London. And of course, it was a particularly dry fall, unlike most falls in London, and then come over and drop explosives on the fire so it would spread the fires. And I remember very well going up with an old friend, still old friend, Bill Stoneman, who was then the correspondent of the Chicago Daily News, on which I had worked earlier, up Ludgate Hill towards St. Paul's Cathedral on this particular night of December 29th, and watching what the cathedral was not hit badly that particular night, but looking up the hill and seeing firemen like little black beetles crawling up these walls that were ensconced in flame with their hoses, which frequently, and on this particular night also, did not emit very much water because there wasn't enough pumping power. The hoses were extended from the Thames, and of course the bombs broke a great many of the water mains. So you'd see these guys going up in what seemed a terribly brave but almost futile effort to put the flames out of the whatever was burning. That particular night, December 29th, the bombs hit Paternoster Row, which was the center of the British publishing, may still be, it may have renewed itself, British Publishing Company. 5 million books were burned in that one night, and the various, it being in the houses of various publishing companies. Of course, the British government had evacuated its more important records and that sort of thing. One of the places I used to like to go was the zoo in Regent's Park. Because while a number of the birds were killed, birds and beasts and whatnot, still the zoo kept open, and mothers and children went there still, sometimes. The bombs didn't, as a rule, fall that particular winter of 1940 until dusk. Dusk began at 4:30, but during the daylight they didn't do very much bombing. And I remember that the birds of paradise, who had always dined on lovely fresh fish, were somehow or other surviving on Brussels sprouts. And one day when I went up, the zoo people said, "Oh, you should have been here yesterday for lunch. Our Barbary sheep caught it last night, and we had him for lunch today." Or it was the day back that the Barbary sheep caught it the day before. Anyway, it was a time of tremendous excitement, and of course for any reporter, tremendous, sometimes 18 to 20 hours a day work. But it proved that Goering's idea that a huge bombing of London would somehow or other ruin the British war interest was mistaken. And I wrote a little thing after having gone back to France, a little thing about the splendor of, I was an alien, of course, I was a foreigner, but the splendor of the behavior of the people of London in that year. If Goring had continued to pound the airfields, he might well have somehow or other been able to arrange for an invading force on the beaches. But afterwards, in 1944, I went back to France, and when I went again back to London, I made a little notation, which I think somehow sums it up. It says, one thing I remember is that when I returned from France in the spring of 1945, I'd gone over there after the Allied troops covered the war in France that winter, down in various fronts, and of course in Paris, and working mostly for the Paris Bureau of Time. I wrote, when I returned from France in the spring of 1945, a fragile looking little vine with a small lavender flower was vigorously clambering over the broken masonry and debris of London's bombed and vacant spaces. A horticulturist told me it had not been seen in London since the Great Fire of 1966. He said that the plant is called London's Pride. I was really terribly touched by that. I'm going to pass over some other writers, Ezra Pound and people like that, to tell you about the writer I knew best. Who was to whom could be applied any assortment of adjectives? He was complex, complicated, ebullient, exasperating, endearing, turbulent, tranquil, violent sometimes, volatile, and in many ways made our life what my definition would be of voluptuous. We worked out a symbiosis which seemed to be beneficial to us both. We were also, aside from being at good friends, both vertically and horizontally, we were good friends in everything, especially in fishing on the sea. I adored the Gulf Stream, to which Ernest introduced me. I had been more or less born and brought up on water in northern Minnesota with my father, and then found in the Gulf Stream such an enormous variety of glorious living creatures, not only the usual yellowfin tuna and dolphin and marlin with those great long snouts and wonderful fighting fish, and marvelous varieties of birds and that kind of thing. A day of fishing aboard Pilar was always a great day for us. We had at the house, I remember one time making a note in my diary that it had been the first day in 54 days when Ernest and I had lunched alone. We had guests. We all would have. We nearly always had house guests. We had not only house guests, but people who came out for lunch. Both Americans who went down to Havana on holiday, and also Europeans, one sort or another. And one of our great things was to escape in Pilar, just the two of us. With our boatman, Gregorio, and buzz 90 miles down the coast to be dominated really with nothing but the wind and the weather. We had an anchorage place which Ernest called Paraíso, meaning paradise, in Spanish, and would swim and walk the beach and fish the reefs in my little boat, which was called the Tin Kid, after me. One of the children nicknamed me the Tin Kid. Anyhow, that was a time of great tranquility, a lot of reading aloud, a lot of simply or reading silently, and peace and quiet and comfortable getting along with each other. I was mentioning lunches, and at the Finca Vigia, our house, and I remember, I wondered whether or not how many of you have eaten loin of lion. In Africa, Ernest has shot a lion, and we were watching it being skinned out, and he leaned down and with his penknife scooped a little piece of the loin, the strip that goes down the side of the spine, and thoughtfully chewed it and then gave me a piece and said, "It's pretty good, isn't it?" And I said, "Yes, why shouldn't we have it?" We couldn't find anybody else in Africa who would eat lion. They said, but it feeds on, bad old stuff, rotten meat. But also we pointed out to them that a great many American farmers, I don't know what they do now, but in the old days used to feed not very attractive food to their pigs, and they still ate the pork. Anyway, we used to have loin of lion, and we once ate a dragon. We were climbing in the hills far above a very remote port, an unoccupied port, I mean just a little river harbor, and saw a dragon. He wasn't as big as the one that St. George killed, and he didn't spit fire, but he did spit at us. And Ernest said, "Why, you naughty dragon, you." And he hit him over the head with a stick or something. And we took him back to Pilar, where Gregorio, our mate, said, "Oh, it's a gift from heaven," or something like that, he said in Spanish. Because it's the most glorious eating thing. And so he skinned our dragon and he cooked him, and he was absolutely delicious. He was a mixture, or close relationship to chicken stew and rabbit stew, and he was absolutely great. I don't suppose perhaps many of you either have eaten a thing which in Spain is considered a great delicacy, which are criadillas. They are served only in the towns of the fiestas of the bullfights, when the bulls, of course, are killed in the ring. And they happen to be the testicles of the bulls, which are sliced up and sauteed and are indeed delicious. That's whether or not you believe it is true. Anyway, we used to, aside from those, we serve that sort of thing at the Finca, but we also serve normal Cuban and American and Criollo food. And we used to sing a lot. I think I might sing one of Ernest's favorite songs, if I can find it here. Maybe I haven't got it. No, I guess not. Anyway, it was a song, a military rebuke, saying, in effect, one of the great Cuban heroes was a man named Maceo, who was killed in a battle at the town, in the area of Guayaquil. And the song says, "Where were you with your handsome face on the day of the death of Maceo? you with your handsome face underneath the bed while we fought at Guayaquil. It goes something like this. Ernest liked it because of the minor tones of the song. It goes something like this. Y tú, ¿dónde estabas el día de la muerte de Maceo? Con tu cara de guapo, handsome, abajo de la cama, underneath the bed. Y nosotros a la Guajiquil, con tu cara de guapo, abajo de la cama. Y nosotros a la Guajiquil. Well, you know, we had a lovely time. Ernest liked me to read aloud. And I remember one of his favorite things. He had given me a really handsome book of Baudelaire poems with illustrations by Rodin. And one of these concerns that wicked, nasty king of Sisyphus, Corinth, the king of Corinth, whose name was Sisyphus. And he used to like me to read aloud this one particular quatrain, which is, pour soulever un poids si lourd, si fils, il faudrait ton courage, bien qu'on dit du cœur à l'ouvrage, là est long, et le temps est court. Ernest's friend Cyril Connolly of the London Times once said, to somebody else, not to me, when you were with him, you never wanted to be anywhere else. And it reminded me of one particular afternoon at the Finca, when once again we had lunch by ourselves, and I had gone in, this was in the hot weather there, one takes a siesta after lunch, not necessarily sleeping, but resting in the heat of the day. And I was lying on my bed, half reading, when Ernest came padding in, bare feet. He almost never wore shoes in the hot weather. And he lifted a few things on his desk and sort of looked under my chair. I said, what are you looking for, sweetheart? He said, I'm looking for an accolade. Because lunch today was the greatest ever in the world. Oh.
Mrs. Hemingway has said that she will answer some questions if you would like to put them to us.
Don't ask any questions. I've talked too long.
Oh, no.
I'd like to ask if Ernest ever identified any particular book of his as one he considered his best.
The question was, did Ernest ever identify any particular book of his that he identified as his best?
That's difficult to answer. I think he was always most enthusiastic about what he was doing at that time. He was even enthusiastic.
Could you?
I didn't like it. I really do think he was always most enthusiastic about what he was doing at the time he was doing it, which of course is great. But I don't think he identified one or another as being his best. He wanted the next one always to be the best. I talked too long, obviously.
No time. Yes. Was he ever in British Columbia at any time?
Not that I recall. He went to Honolulu one time, but that was from, San Francisco. Otherwise, I don't remember. Of course, you know he worked on the Toronto Star when he was a youngster. But in this part of Canada, as far as I recall, I don't remember his ever mentioning anything. Idaho is in many ways sufficient. Yes. Love Spanish?
Paris.
Paris. Oh, of course you don't. Who couldn't adore Paris? Yes, indeed he did. And we used to spend, whenever we could, you know, hours just walking around his old part of the Left Bank, my old part, I had lived there also, of the Left Bank, and browsing in the bookstalls along the Seine, that sort of thing. Oh, yes, indeed. Yeah.
Who was the writer that anyway admired the most among the ones that were there?
Who was the writer he liked the most?
Yeah.
Who was the writer that Hemingway admired the most?
Yes. You know, really, I feel inadequate to speak for him in matters like this because he read extensively, constantly. When we went on Pilar, for example, we always had a whole bag full of books. When we went to Africa, we had two large bags full of books to read. We were always, it would be comparatively accurate, I think, to say that he admired Tolstoy as much as any other writer. But I would hate to be quoted because he also admired Dostoevsky. He also, you know, there are a great many there was seldom at any time in the 17 years I knew him when he didn't have one or another Shakespeare plays open. He read four or five books, bits of four or five books at a time. I knew that they were being read, and the servants, of course, knew because they would be bad for the bindings, but open-faced. Face down, open face down, and that would mean, and he'd pick up one and then pick up another. But to say definitely one or another, I couldn't assume the responsibility. I don't think it had any biographical significance. Ernest wrote it basically as a piece of fiction. Of course, it was based on his own time in Pilar hunting German submarines before he went to, in 1943, off the north coast of Cuba. But I think it's visually a very... But I love sea and boats, so I think it's very attractive visually.
Ms. Hemingway, the name Pilar, of course, makes us think of For Whom the Bell Tolls. Did Ernest think that the film production of For Whom the Bell Tolls was well done?
It so happens that Ernest disapproved of nearly all but one of the films that were made. about For Whom the Bell Tolls, he said that that's stupid. He and Gary Cooper were personal friends. We used to pheasant shoot together out west, in Idaho. He said, Coop's going up there, climbing up that mountain in those brand new Abercrombie and Fitch clothes is ridiculous. But he was particularly interested in accuracy in all details. For example, they made one version of The Sun Also Rises, and I guess, I don't know, to save money or something, they made it in Mexico, and Ernest was horrified to see that there was just a couple of frames, but a short thing of the people looking at the bullfighting, and the people were obviously not Spaniards, they were Mexican faces, and this horrified Ernest. What he said about the old man in the sea, the actor?
Spencer Tracy.
They got along very well, personally. When he saw the film, he said, there is Tracy with his great big white fat feet pretending to be a starving old fisherman. I hear you, but I don't understand you.
Do you remember the remark that Ernest made in the Movable Feast, about Wittgenstein when he said that you had to look best to make just such a devastating remark when he had what I
said? I don't remember what he said in a Movable Feast. Was he rude about Gertrude? I missed it.
You said it wasn't charming. You didn't say what it
was. Oh. I remember his having said that she was very kind to him when he was a young man, and that she served some sort of French liqueur, that essence of raspberry or strawberry or something like that, which he enjoyed very much indeed and couldn't afford himself. And then I remember that in when we first got to Paris in the autumn of 19, when did we invade? 44. In August of 1944, Ernest took me over to 5 Rue de Fleurus, her house, and was told by the concierge that she was in the country and wouldn't be back, and left a note. And then subsequently, she came for some reason or other, without Miss Toklas, she came to the Ritz where we were living to lunch one day with some other people, and she and Ernest had a very polite, but I would, cordial would be a slight, I'm afraid it's a slight exaggeration, but at least a polite exchange of something. I don't know what they broke up over. Or if they indeed they really did break up, I don't know.
Yes.
It was The Killers.
The question was, there was only one picture that Mr. Hemingway approved of, and that was The Killers. That's the answer.
Yeah.
I just want to pass it on there, but yes.
Norman Mailer is often referred to as Ernest Hemingway's literary heir in America. I wonder what you think of Mailer's work, and do you think...
Oh, I think he's marvelous.
Do you think that there are themes in it that are comparable to your late husband's work?
Did you hear that? The questioner is saying that Norman Mailer is referred to as Ernest Hemingway's literary heir. And Mrs. Hemingway's been asked to comment upon that. You said you think he's marvelous?
I think Norman, he has the most marvelous brain, and that he certainly nobody could compare their styles at all. But I think he's a marvelous writer, and with this wildly exploring brain, and very, very good. But obviously, as you know, his style is entirely different from that of Ernest.
Well, Ms. Hemingway, I don't think you've spoken too long, but I think you've said it all. There's no questions to be asked. I'm going to ask Eric Vogt to give our thanks to the speaker.
Ladies and gentlemen, we're indeed fortunate to finish the season with an evening with Mary Hemingway. Northern Minnesota, you know, is a cold, beautiful, God-forsaken place, and it's always raised people of Bunyanist proportions, personalities of Bunyanist proportions, and legends of Bunyanist proportions. In fact, you know, they believe in dragons there. And I think it's clear today that we have we've seen the kind of personality that's attracted interesting people for decades throughout the world, and we're grateful for Mary Hemingway today. Not only for coming here, and we're grateful to the sun for bringing her here today, but we're also grateful, I think, and I want to thank her for all of you, that through all these decades, neither Goering, nor Beaverbrook, nor Shaw, nor all of the other people that she's met have broken her spirit.
See you next year, everybody.
There's a lack of oxygen at the bottom.